earth, sky.
It used to be, since the time of Aristotle, that feathers were thought to be synonymous with birds. And in literally the last 10 years, we've discovered that that's not true. Feathers originated in dinosaurs, evolved in the dinosaurs before the origin of birds and before the origin of flight.
You're listening to Richard Prum, an expert on feathers and MacArthur Fellow at Yale University. And this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. In 2010, Prum became the first scientist to reconstruct the full plumage of a dinosaur in color. Dr. Prum talked to Earth Sky about what his study on feathers means for biologists and the public.
Which came first, the feathers or birds?
Feathers originated in dinosaurs, evolved in the dinosaurs before the origin of birds and before the origin of flight. And that's been an astounding result, given that biologists spent over a century thinking that feathers had actually evolved for flight. So that changed our view dramatically. This has led to a lot of confusion, because now there's a lot of animals that have feathers that we wouldn't necessarily call birds. That is unsettling for both some dinosaur paleontologists and for ornithologists as well. The result is, though, that we know a lot more than we used to, and as a result, dividing the group or deciding what we're actually going to call birds becomes a little more ambiguous.
What did those creatures use feathers for if they weren't using them for flight?
That's a great question, but it's one that we now have only glimmers of an answer for. It's interesting, though, because our lack of knowledge about the function of early feathers is coincident with new discoveries about what those feathers actually were like. It looks as though the earliest feathers were likely simple tubes, followed by a tuft of filaments, of a fuzzy tuft like a down feather, followed by a more complex branched feather. So that's certainly supported by the paleontological record and by developmental information about living bird feathers. What they actually use them for and how they fit into the lives of dinosaurs is a little more problematic, probably or possibly including things like thermoregulation, like controlling body temperature, insulation, or perhaps even display or protection from predators.
As far as the display issue goes, there's been some recent research reported about color of feathers in dinosaurs. Is that related to your research?
Sure. We have just recently published a paper where we were able to reconstruct the color in some pretty substantial detail of the plumage of a troodontid dinosaur. That's a non-avian bipedal meat-eating dinosaur. We were able to use an electron microscope to image very, very tiny objects in the feathers of the fossil of this dinosaur. And when doing so, we discovered that there were tiny particles that had been preserved that were the original pigment granules that had been in the feathers of the animal when it was alive. And because these pigment granules that contain melanin pigments, the kind of pigments that produce black hair and red hair and blonde hair in humans or in mammals, are preserved really well, we could recreate, indeed re-describe, the plumage variation, the color the variation in plumage coloration over the body of the animal in substantial detail. And it was a surprisingly striking animal.
So is it possible that we'll be finding these structures in other kinds of dinosaurs other than the theropod dinosaurs?
It looks like feathers themselves were restricted to a lineage of theropod dinosaurs. There are other sorts of places in the skin or in the eye where melanin pigments will probably be found as well-preserved. But they're not preserved everywhere. A lot of fossil locations just have the major bones and wouldn't have the beautiful detail necessary to preserve these fine feather and hair structures. So far, we've been able to find black and gray, a rufous or reddish-brown, white, of course. And we, last year in a fossil feather, we also found a structural color, a color that was probably an oily green or oily bronzy color, like a starling or a grackle. beyond that, it might get a little tough. Most of those other colors, the reds and the yellows and oranges, are produced by pigments that are not bound up into tight little granules like melanins are. Other structural colors, are probably made out of proteins that probably didn't fossilize as well. So there may be limits to the breadth of the palette that we'll be able to discover.
Can you tell us a little bit about what structural color means as opposed to the melanosomes, the tiny structures you found in the fossils?
Biological colors are produced by two major mechanisms. One is with molecular pigments. So these are molecules that, like the dye in clothing, absorb some wavelengths of light and not others. In contrast, there's some whole other class of colors that are called structural colors, and they're produced by light interacting with the structure of the material, usually a nanostructure. And they operate essentially like a rainbow, or like an oil slick, or like a prism, in interacting optically with light, and they produce many of the most brilliant colors that we find in nature, including the peacock's tail, or a hummingbird, or many tropical reef fishes, all sorts of animals incorporate or use structural colors in their skin.
Do humans have any kind of structural color to them?
Human blue eyes are actually a structural color. It turns out that there are very few blue pigments anywhere in animals. So wherever you see blue, you're pretty likely to be looking at a structural color.
So this leads us into the issue of photonics, which is another area that you do research in. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm very interested in the structure and function of these blue colors in birds, in particular how feathers grow, the tiny nanostructures that create these colors. It turns out that these feathers often make these colors with tiny air bubbles in the feathers.
Can you tell us how small a nanostructure is?
A nanometer is tens of millions of an inch. It's a tiny face. It's actually smaller than the wavelengths of visible light. So in order to make a color, the material actually be structured at a size scale that's on the size of visible light or even smaller. And so these air bubbles in the feathers have to be very precisely tuned in order to create the right color in order to function in the social lives of the birds, either in attracting mates or useful in communication or to be recognized as one of the flock. So birds have to grow these things with beautiful detail and beautiful specificity, and we are interested in knowing how that works. That leads to the area of photonics, which is the area of technology that uses the flow of light to try to make calculations or to operate machinery. So the field of electronics works through controlling the flow of electrons, and photonics, by comparison, is the field that aspires to use the flow of light in a similar way. So our world is, in the last century, has become populated with electronic devices. And many engineers and technologists think that the next century will be populated by photonic materials. Those photonic devices require growing or constructing very, very fine-scale optical devices. And we're actually hoping that by learning how birds do it, that we may be able to figure out new ways that technologies can be developed that are based on the blue jay or the blue bird.
You've been listening to Richard Prohm of Yale University. He's an ornithologist, optics expert, and also a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.